Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On the show this morning, Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz looks into General Michael Flynn's Russia ties and into the leaks that led to his resignation as National Security Advisor. Plus, the trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow, now in its second week, sees some unusual turns. And the departure of the Outdoor Retailers Show, news from the state legislature, and more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt.
No problem.
Columnist Paul Raleigh is in studio with us as well. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning.
And on the phone from the nation's capital, Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Welcome, Tommy. Thanks to you as well.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join this conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Thomas Burr, let's start with some news out of Washington. Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz, who is the chair of the House Oversight Committee, is looking to investigate or is at least requesting information on Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who resigned this week, and also the people who leaked the information that brought him down. A divergent approach here. Maybe remind us first off why Flynn stepped down, because that's obviously that plays into the second part of this story.
Yeah, sure. It's still hard to believe we're not even a full month yet into President Trump's term, which has just been a heck of a roller coaster for us here in Washington, and I'm sure the rest of the country right now. So Michael Flynn has been a longtime, advisor to Donald Trump and kind of a right-hand man when it comes to some of these things. He's a fiery, retired lieutenant general from the Army. And Trump brought him aboard as National Security Advisor. But as he's bringing him aboard, apparently the Justice Department approached the White House and said, hey, you should know that on multiple occasions he was having contact with the Russian ambassador to the United States. And apparently, despite initial denials from Flynn, they did discuss in some form the sanctions that President Obama had handed down for Russia's supposed meddling in the U.S. election last year. Mm-hmm. Flynn kept saying, no, we didn't discuss that, but then later clarified that he wasn't sure, he couldn't remember if he discussed that. The Justice Department told the White House, yes, they did. That all came out in leaks. The Washington Post had 9 former or current intelligence officials telling them that this discussion did happen. And only after that came out did the White House act, after, of course, initially saying, no, we, have the full confidence of the president. Flynn's doing a great job. The White House, the president actually asked for Flynn's resignation, and that was tendered. So now Chaffetz is going two different ways. So one, he has not necessarily said, although he says the door is open, investigated or launched an investigation into anything to do with the conversations with the ambassador and whether he violated the Logan Act, a law that says private citizens can't be interfering in international politics and diplomatic stuff.
Wait, hold on just one second, Thomas. He's not launching an investigation on the phone calls. I just wanted to clarify that. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That so far he said he's open to it, but he has not launched an investigation of that. What he has done is sent a letter to essentially the Speaker's Bureau that had booked Flynn, including booking him for a Kremlin-backed news outlet called RT, where Flynn gave a speech in 2015, I believe it was, sat next to Vladimir Putin, and Chaffetz wants to, did he get any, pay for that? And if he did that violate the emolument clause? I can never say that word.
Emoluments?
Exactly. In the Constitution that says that, foreign government can't be paying a U.S. official, and a retired general counts as a U.S. official. So he's doing that, but he hasn't probed phone calls.
Okay.
But the second part of what Chaffetz is doing is going after the leakers. Again, not going after, what Flynn may have done in those phone calls with the Russian ambassador, but going after the people who leaked the information to the news media. So, yeah, it's kind of a two-prong approach. Just to add one more thing,
sure.
Chaffetz, because it's been a busy week, Chaffetz also sent a letter to the White House asking questions about the White House's handling of classified materials. I'm sure the listeners probably saw these pictures of Trump huddled in Mar-a-Lago with, you know, cell phone cameras, cell phone, you know, flashlights being used to read sensitive documents in the middle of a ballroom, a dining room at Mar-a-Lago. And Chaffetz wants to know how that was handled, given, you know, you're supposed to be doing those kind of things in a secured facility and not in the middle of a restaurant.
Well, a restaurant, and also it's worth pointing out a Trump-owned country club. I actually have a question about this. When the president is there as you know, as the president, he's there at Mar-a-Lago, and he's called this the Winter White House. Are the people who pay to be country club members there as well, you know, getting to mingle with the president? And isn't that kind of paying for access?
You know, I'll let the congressional watchdogs and other groups decide whether that's paying to have access to the president. But the answer is yes, they're there. And in fact, that's how we know of these, you know, we have these photos of Trump and advisors sitting around the dining room table looking at stuff because one of the people there just snapped the photo and posted it on Facebook. And so, yeah, there is. The White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said there's a SCIF, which is a secured facility inside Mar-a-Lago where they can go, where, you know, we can't be bugged, and it's they can have these conversations about classified materials, which he says that the president was in before and after dinner. But the photo about what were they actually looking at, and in an open dining room talking about North Korea and North Korean missile test, and does that break any laws? Because, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Roger, you and I sitting down in the middle of Cafe Rio or something like that and having a discussion about classified material.
Right. That wouldn't fly. You know, just going back to to what Chaffetz is doing, so he's asked for information on how sensitive information is being handled at this country club. There have been calls for investigations into other connections. We talked about Michael Flynn, but into any other connections between Trump's team and Russia. This after the New York Times reported that Trump's campaign team had various contacts with members of Russian intelligence. And after U.S. intelligence agencies have said that Russia was involved in American election hacking, you actually wrote about this from a different angle, and I want to go there. But first, is Chaffetz planning to use his role on the House Oversight Committee to look into any of that?
So far, no. Okay. Right now, he's focused on, you know, the Michael Flynn speech in Moscow. He's focused on the leakers, and he's sent a letter to the White House about the Mar-a-Lago thing. And let's just remember, these are letters. These are not subpoenas. These are not, you know, forcing them to say anything. It's pretty much a, hey, would you tell me a little more about this, with no, you know, backing other than, you know, he could later on send a subpoena if they don't respond. So right now he's not closed any doors, but he's says he's not, you know, interested in going down the rabbit hole of, he would term it, of just, you know, opening up an investigation after investigation into what the White House is doing. So there have been a lot of calls for him to do so, and it is somewhat, you know, his role to actually be the congressional watchdog and use his power to look at some of these things that have raised a lot of questions.
I want to remind our listeners that we invite you to join this conversation. What should Representative Chaffetz be investigating in your opinion? Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Paul Raleigh from the Opinion Desk here. I'm just kind of curious to get your take on you know, we've talked about Chaffetz. He had the town hall here in Salt Lake City, faced quite a lot of uproar from people, from local constituents who were asking for these same sorts of things, a deeper investigation of, I guess, the president's, you know, conflicts of interest in business, but also potential ties to Russia and so on. Chaffetz is kind of, you know, making a turn from where he was on this last week. We heard him saying he wasn't going to go on any fishing expeditions, but maybe things have changed a bit and he's doing something different, or is this enough?
Well, a cynic might say that Chaffetz has shown that he's using his chairmanship of the Oversight Committee for partisan political reasons. If you look at all the things he's gone after, and now he's talking about, you know, looking into the Russian ties and a little bit. I think that that's a result of a lot of pressure now he's been getting. He's become a kind of a national figure now. I mean, people are paying attention to him, and not necessarily in a good way. Now feel like they can kind of make fun of him just the way he's acted and who he's decided to go after. Dana Milbank had a column the other day talking about, it was very funny, talking about Chaffetz is now zeroing in on Sesame Street characters, and all this stuff, but while still ignoring, some of these allegations on the Russian ties. But, that crowd that was there, a lot of people are saying that they probably, he would probably get reelected as long as he wants anyway because of his district in Utah. But the crowd has been criticized for the way they treated him. You know, my take on that is I think these people were just showing how frustrated they are that they feel they have no voice.
Hmm. I actually want to go back to something that I said, which was that there have been calls for probes into Trump's conflicts of interest, and I mentioned Mar-a-Lago, this country club in Florida that he goes to, calls the Winter White House. He has, to some extent, and Tommy, I'll bring you back in on this, sort of divested himself of that conflict. But is there anybody probing that conflict of interest at the congressional level?
Yeah, sort of is a great way of saying that. So what the president did was essentially put his children in charge of running his business, but he hasn't divested himself. So he is still the owner of, all these Trump businesses, international businesses, but he has supposedly no active role in managing them. That doesn't mean he's still not making money off of all these things going on. So one of the things that Chaffetz is doing that has a lot of people riled up is there's the Trump Hotel here in Washington, about three blocks from my office, where it's a government-owned building that Trump is leasing, and Chaffetz has requested the contract. He wants to know, what is the deal with Trump being a signatory on the lease with the General Services Administration, and does that have any conflicts with that constitutional clause we were talking about? He has requested information about that. He says he hasn't received everything and he hasn't determined anything necessarily, but he is looking at that. So he is, Chaffetz has been dancing around some of the issues that have come up. He's not gone as far as some people want him to go, that's for sure, but he is taking at least a look at one of them.
Tommy, circling back now to those calls for an investigation into the Trump team's ties with Russia, and this is, I think, especially the campaign team leading up to the election, and election hacking that officials say happened. You have one. You spoke with one former U.S. intelligence agent in particular, who is calling for a deep dive into the Trump-Russia connection, and it's a well-known person here in Utah. Tell us about this.
Yes, it is. So Evan McMullen came on stage last year in Utah when he decided to run for president. He knew that he wasn't going to win, the 270 electoral votes, but he was trying to at least deny Trump enough electoral votes to become president. Obviously, that did not work. But McMullen is a former undercover CIA agent, and he tells me that he's still very much in contact with his friends in the intelligence community, and that they're pretty scared, that they're very nervous about the threat, as he said, that Trump poses to national security. And he thinks that there needs to be, he wants a special select committee, which is something the Congress does when they have an issue like they did it for Benghazi, for example. They have others that they'll call up. There was a Watergate Commission at one point, those kind of things. So he's calling for something of that level, not just, Chaffetz doing it in oversight, but actually having a separate committee whose entire job would be to look at these Russian ties and meddling in the election, whether they were actually trying to, help Trump, for example, and hurt Hillary Clinton. McMullen, he's not a member of Congress. He has no position to actually, make any changes there, but he's been very vocal. He was on CNN and other news stations, news networks this week, just trying to raise that issue. We'll see where that goes. Again, at the moment, there are some senators who have said they are open to taking a look at this, more focused on Michael Flynn and his contacts with Russia. But right now, look, you have a GOP House, you have a GOP Senate, and usually in that situation, they're very wary of investigating a GOP White House.
Not so much in the way of momentum at the moment, and that could also put a damper on their own plans to have certain policies that they want to see enacted, investigating their own party. I want to remind listeners the number to call is 801-355-8255 if you want to join this conversation with your questions and comments. We are going to have to go to our first break. And Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, I know you've got places to be, so we will let you go, but many thanks for this.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Again, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll turn to the twists and turns in the trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow, and also outdoor retailers are leaving Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Justice and Safety Reporter Jennifer Dobner should be joining us soon, and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh as well. You can join the conversation with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-8255. Talk. And maybe what we'll do now is turn to a little bit of legislative coverage. And Matt Canham, senior managing editor at the Salt Lake Tribune, a story that we've covered pretty extensively last week, the Outdoor Industry Association, which hosts the biannual Outdoor Retailers Show here in Salt Lake City, says the show will leave town. And the reason has to do with specific state actions on public lands. And this announcement comes after industry leaders had a phone call with Governor Gary Herbert. Maybe you can tell us about this.
Yes, this all started after the Bears Ears National Monument was created by President Barack Obama on his way out of office. And at that point, Utah's elected officials had a big problem with that national monument, are trying to get Donald Trump to kill it. And the state legislature passed a resolution to do that. In the wake of this, many of Utah's outdoor industry leaders, as well as national figures, tried to push back and say, look, we come to your state twice a year. We have a huge convention, one of the biggest conventions in the nation, that brings $40 million. We can, you know, we don't want to be here if you're going to be against everything that we believe in. Now, we've had the Outdoor Retailers Convention say these kind of things before. And so there were some people who believed that they were just calling, you know, that they were just bluffing, that they were just trying to pressure the government. But then it started cascading. You had Patagonia say they're not going to be here anymore. You had, REI saying, like, well, maybe we should, you know, start looking stronger. This outdoor industry group put a list of five things they wanted the governor to do, which essentially included backing away from trying to get rid of the Bears Ears National Monument. It included saying, you know, stop fighting the idea of the Antiquities Act, which allows a president to create such a monument. Mm-hmm. And they had a phone call yesterday with the governor. The governor did not satisfy them. The call ended curtly, is the way the governor's office put it. And right an hour or two afterward, the Outdoor Retailers or Outdoor Industry Association said, we're going to look for other places to have this convention, and we are not going to let Salt Lake City or any city in Utah bid for it.
Right, we're not going to invite
them. We're gone.
Okay, so we're gone altogether. The governor, again, you mentioned this list of demands that includes Antiquities Act, backing off the state's entire position on public lands. The governor has pretty consistently said that the state would do a better job managing these lands. The industry is happy with federal management and conservation. And that's got to be the end of the conversation right there. I mean, there's no middle ground there.
Well, and it's hard politically to have a group like the Outdoor Industry Association make an ultimatum to the governor and have the governor accept it. And he's a Republican in a Republican state where a lot of voters agree with the position that the legislature and he is taking. So politically, that's a pretty hard sell. It's hard to imagine that was going to go well. I think it was one of those things where the outdoor retailers were already decided that they wanted to go to a place that the politics was more similar to what their industry believes in. And so this was just the final check of the box.
A quick reminder to listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories we're covering. What does the loss of outdoor retailers mean to you? Are you pleased? Are you bothered? Give us a call, 801-355-TALK, or comment at sltrib.com. Paul Raleigh, the opinion columnist, the outdoor industry is making a point here. I don't know exactly how to ask this, but they've now maybe relinquished their ability to make that point any longer. Again, what's your take on this?
Well, I don't know how to answer that about them not being able to make their point any longer. They've, as Matt said, they've threatened to do this before, and I think that the animosity between state leaders and the outdoor retailers has been growing and growing. Utah probably, you could argue, is the most hostile, state politically, I mean, of its leaders when talking about taking federal lands, you know, back and putting them in state hands and possible private hands and everything else, which is something that the outdoor industry certainly doesn't want. Utah is the only state that has authorized, a lot of money to go ahead and sue the federal government to transfer these lands to state control. And so I think that the hard feelings have been growing and growing, and it just reached a point now, and when Governor Herbert couldn't satisfy, I mean, Governor Herbert's on record as being one of those who wants to take, have transfer federal lands, so he's very much in that camp. And I just, at some point, I think they just realized that there's no meeting of the minds here.
Outdoor Industry Association making good on a threat that it's been making for a while now. A statement released by Paul Edwards, the governor's chief of staff, last night called the decision to not let Utah bid on these shows, quote, offensive. He said that this shows how a political agenda, rather than reason or merit, seems to have captured the decision-making at the Outdoor Industry Association. To some extent, this is a political agenda on both sides, isn't it?
Well, yeah. See, when I saw that quote, I'd say, well, people could say, that Governor Herbert and the legislature, they've got a political agenda, and they're doing the same thing. I guess a political agenda in the negative term is whatever your opponent is doing at the time.
The one part that reason might come in here is that you can make a pretty convincing argument that Salt Lake City is the best place for an outdoor retailers convention. We have lots of different outdoor activities that are close. Denver's making a big push to get this convention.
Right.
If you want to go do a skiing demo day for the outdoor retailers, you got to drive like half a day to get to a good Colorado ski resort. Obviously, in Salt Lake City, getting up the canyon is not exactly a challenge. So that's what Utah's always banked on. That we have a lot of things going for us. Logistically, we're, the best place to do this. For a lot of these outdoor activities, it is so much easier to get around here. At the end of the day, politics did matter, and that's what happened.
The scales tipped apparently between that convenience factor and
right.
and the political statement. You mentioned Denver and Colorado actively trying to solicit or court, I guess, the Outdoor Industry Association to bring their show to Colorado. In fact, they, if I'm not mistaken, had a couple of large advertisements both in the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News this week, trumping up their own abilities.
Right. This was a conservation group in Colorado who paid for this ad that also pointed out that they have better beer than we do. And I think some breweries in Salt Lake City might have
offense
to that. But they made a little bit of light of it. Interesting, in the past, when Outdoor Retailers has flirted with other cities, they've been cities like Houston and Orlando, places where you don't think outdoor recreation. So it's never been felt like a serious threat. Now that they're actually actively looking, I'm sure Denver will be on the short list. I'm not sure what other cities can, because this is a very big convention. Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County expanded the Salt Palace to have this convention, and even then it wasn't big enough, that they still have an outdoor lot that they turn into overflow. So whatever city has this has to have a massive, massive convention center.
Okay. I want to just go to a quick comment here. This is Nate in Salt Lake, says he hates to see OR go, but thinks that there needs to be pressure on our leaders. That's his comment when he called in and left his comment with our call screener. Guys, I want to come back to the topic of outdoors funding, especially for issues related to how the state is dealing with public lands in Utah, because there's a legislative tie-in here. But I think that before we do that, we should go back, while we have her on the line, to Jennifer Dobner, who is covering the public corruption trial against John Swallow. Jennifer, are you there?
I am.
Okay, thanks for making some time this morning. You have been at this trial, I think, from the first day, from day one, and I want to start here with what was kind of a surprising turn in this trial that occurred this week, that a key witness, maybe the key witness in this trial, isn't talking. This is Jeremy Johnson, And Jennifer, I thought he was offered immunity for the testimony that he was going to provide. Why is he clamming up now?
Well, he was offered immunity, but Mr. Johnson is in a sort of a unique position in that he's been prosecuted by the federal government in a couple of ways. One, in a criminal trial when he was convicted of some bank fraud-related charges last year. Also, he's been sued by the Federal Trade Commission, and he's also presently trying to work his way through an action from the Federal Elections Commission. And the criminal charges and the federal elections and the FEC stuff followed the FTC action. And I know this is very complicated, but when he started talking, he was promised some immunity, and the federal government did not honor it. And so he has a real fear of continued federal prosecution, and that's why he doesn't want to talk.
Okay, so he's not talking, and this is a couple of days running now that he's been brought to court, put on the witness stand,
yep.
and hasn't said anything.
So today was the third day, and his attorneys are engaged in a conversation with the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office and the U.S. Department of Justice about an immunity deal that will satisfy them, him and them. Mm-hmm. The first offer was rejected by Mr. Johnson. The second offer was rejected by the Department of Justice, and that's where we are today. They're still trying to work it out. So he was ordered in found in contempt of court and ordered to spend 30 days in the Salt Lake County Jail. Mm-hmm. That may not be a big deal because he's already serving an 11-year prison sentence, and he was here under a writ and in the custody of the FBI. But he was staying in a hotel and under FBI guard, and then he went to jail. Today they've sort of rejiggered that arrangement, and he's going to be back in a hotel over the weekend under a federal guard so that his attorneys have access to him to try and work this issue out.
Okay. And as you said, he's already serving...
So this is,
Go ahead.
He's
already serving an 11-year...
I was going to say...
Go ahead, Jennifer. I'm cutting you off.
Sorry. This is significant because four of the 13 criminal counts faced by Mr. Swallow are tied to Mr. Johnson. They're all second-degree level felonies, serious crimes of bribery, accepting a gift, and racketeering. If they can't get him on the stand, prosecutors are going to have a couple of options. One would be to see if they can elicit that testimony from someone else or enter it in some other way through other pieces of evidence. Or they may have to look at tossing out some of the counts that they are trying to that they're prosecuting right now.
Okay, so his testimony is key in certain of those charges. It's not the whole case though, right? I mean, there are other options for prosecutors.
No, it's not the whole case, but these things involve gifts and that went to Mr. Swallow when he was in public office. They involve allegations of Mr. Swallow seeking a bribe from Mr. Johnson in order to help him, get out from under the FTC scrutiny. They are significant charges. And Mr. Johnson, along with another businessman, Mr. Mark Jensen, those were the two critical witnesses that prosecutors talked to the jury about on day one of the trial. So if you promise the jury that and then you don't deliver, that will raise a lot of questions for the jury.
Okay. Earlier this week, on Tuesday, in fact, the trial of John Swallow centered around a different figure. This is Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff. And the picture that I think I'm assuming this is Swallow's defense attorneys were trying to paint was that Swallow was a bit player at most here and not the leading figure that they say Shurtleff was in the alleged scheme to solicit money and favors for legal cover for their companies.
Yeah, and Mr. Shurtleff has had a huge presence from the very first, and that's not really a surprise. The racketeering charge is a pattern of unlawful activity, is what they actually call it. Implies a conspiracy, and that means you have to have more than one person. Hmm. And I don't think anyone is arguing that although Mr. Shurtleff case has been dismissed, Swallow and Mr. Shurtleff and a third person, Mr. Lawson, from the prosecution's perspective, were all involved together in a triangle to, solicit money, get them in office, and amass power. So much of the testimony we've heard is about Mr. Shurtleff's role in that enterprise, for lack of a better word,
sure.
and how Mr. Swallow was a part of that.
Jennifer, just quickly, is Shurtleff entirely off the hook here, meaning he had charges against him dropped? Is anything pending with him?
That's a complicated question.
Okay.
He's participating in an ongoing investigation of other public corruption, which may or may not result in a grand jury and future criminal charges. But he presently is not facing any charges.
Okay. Well, hold that thought for just a moment, because we have a caller. This is Carl from St. George, who says that he thinks it's a travesty. The charge. Oh, excuse me, Carl. You can tell us what you think. What's your comment?
Thank you. I just think it's a tragedy and a travesty that the case against Shurtleff was dropped. And the one reason is that we as the common people hear that it was because they couldn't get evidence from the federal government. Now, right from the beginning, there was talk that Harry Reid was involved in this. But to have that dropped just because they couldn't get evidence, something is really wrong. Mm-hmm. And now a Swallow clamming up. Apparently, there's a lot of pressure from Washington coming to be able to take these high-profile individuals and basically just say, hey, there's nothing here that we can see. There's some smoke, but there's no fire. Isn't there a senator from Logan or one that's really pressing for a grand jury on this? And can we support that goes forth to see really that there's fire here, apparently?
Thank you, Carl, for that comment. Jennifer Doebner, I'm not certain about the pressing for a grand jury there, but how about the rest of that comment?
Well, Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings has been pressing for a grand jury for about a year, and that is in part because information that he believes is being held by the federal government or withheld by the federal government that was critical to him in prosecuting Mr. Shurtleff was not made available to him. It was denied to him. And in the Swallow case, Swallow's attorney, Mr. Williams, Scott Williams, has been trying to get similar pieces of evidence also without success. So there have been what appear to be some roadblocks thrown up at the federal level that have gotten in the way of, at least clearly in Mr. Shurtleff's case, the state's ability to prosecute him.
Okay.
So,
Jennifer,
and you know, we wrote a story about whether or not there was an alleged bribe of Harry Reid was real, but we also got no comment from the federal government. So,
well, and there's so many facets to this story that, you know, the case about Swallow is has to do with these unlawful gifts or alleged unlawful gifts in exchange for favors from the Attorney General's office, or promise of favors, I should say. The arms kind of spiral out from there. And, you know, we were talking about Johnson's company, iWorks. One of the allegations, and this is something that Carl was referring to, was that John Swallow, this is an allegation made back in 2013, served as the kind of middleman to try to get the Federal Trade Commission to stop an investigation into his company for this investigation had to do with kind of mass scale automatic billing fraud. And what I'm trying to ask here is Johnson's allegation that Swallow helped him bribe then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, is that going to be part of this trial?
Well, we expected Johnson to testify that he had sought assistance from Mr. Swallow in connecting with lobbying help of some sort through some contacts Mr. Swallow had when he was working in the payday loan industry. I don't know now if Mr. Johnson is going to testify, and if he isn't, how that information might get introduced. There are other witnesses the state could call, other people connected to the payday loan industry, but at this point, we're not really sure which way this is going to turn.
Okay. You know, we haven't really even scratched the surface on this case yet. How much time is left in the trial? Do we have a schedule of that? When is this supposed to end?
Well, we had a schedule that was supposed to be 16 days, and we were on track to go till March 3rd. But at this point, we're several days and several witnesses behind.
Right.
And also the Johnson hiccup may or may not delay that further. It's a little unclear. But I expect sometime in the second week of March, this might be handed over to a jury.
Okay. Well, Jennifer Doudna, reporting by you and Tom Harvey and others at the Salt Lake Tribune on this case is pretty remarkable. And you've been live tweeting the trial as well. Listeners, you can check it out at sltrib.com. Jennifer, what's your Twitter handle really quickly?
Just at Jennifer Doudna.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we still have a bit of news to cover here on the show, but right now we are going to have to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll return to news from the Utah State Legislature. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined for the remainder of this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham and Paul Raleigh. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Before we turn to the story of the trial of John Swallow, we were talking about some of the complications stemming from the fact that the outdoor retailers industry was going to move its convention somewhere else in the United States and not going to allow Utah to bid on new shows coming or shows that they're going to have. There's a little bit of a legislative tie-in to that story in the form of these resolutions on national monuments. And maybe we can stick or go to the topic of public lands. Sure. And the legislature, because Matt Canham, the Tribune, reported this week on some appropriations requests that were made that had to do with public lands for lobbying efforts in D.C., among other things. Maybe tell us about who is asking for what, and then we can dig a little bit further into that.
Sure. Unlike on the federal government, where Congress has got rid of earmarks, money directed towards individual projects by individual members of Congress, the legislature here in Utah likes them. And this has been a growing area, is targeting groups that will advocate for the public lands positions held by Utah's Republicans in the legislature. So this week we had the Natural Resources, Agriculture, and Environmental Quality Appropriations Subcommittee. Sounds like a good time. They had a meeting where $4.6 million was requested, and they prioritized where this money would go. A major chunk would go to a new group called the Foundation for Integrated Resource Management, or FIRM.
Right.
And the goal of this nonprofit is to fight the Bears Ears National Monument and restrictions in Recapture Canyon. And their argument is there is federal law that allows a nonprofit that sues the government and wins to get attorney's fees. So instead of having the state of Utah make this lawsuit, and whether if they win, they just lose the money it costs for the case, seed this group, give some of the money for this group, and then when this group wins, the federal government will have to pay them all the attorney's fees. It's a cheaper model. So this is what they're trying to accomplish. And they're asking for $500,000 to get this group up and running and growing. And then they would ask counties to pay for some of this. And then they would have a cheaper avenue to make this lawsuit, which is going to be a challenging lawsuit for them to win from a lot of legal analysis. Trying to get the federal government to change some designations or ultimately to cede control of this land to states is not as easy. FIRM is saying they're not going to try to do the whole give us the land back thing. They want to change how each parcel is managed. But even that, those are long and involved lawsuits.
And again, $500,000 for this group, Foundation for Integrated Resource Management FIRM. They're, I believe, a relatively new group that showed up asking for this. I'm kind of curious how often state money goes into efforts that end up being kind of lobbying efforts, because part of what they described was you know, having conversations with the new administration,
right,
educating them on public lands. I'm sure that you know, courting specific industries happens all the time with state funds.
This does happen in some areas. It can happen in healthcare. It can happen in transportation. This is a more inflammatory area that it's happening. And usually you'll have lobbying campaigns against cancer. There's not a lot of pro-cancer groups. But this is where there's a lot of political disagreement. One group that has got the most attention is Big Game Forever.
Right.
This is a group that relies on Representative Mike Noel to be their champion in the legislature. And so far, this group has received $5 million from Utah taxpayers to lobby against sage grouse designation as an endangered species and other environmental
wolves
issues.
Are in there somewhere.
Wolves as well. And they have never explained to the legislature how they spent the $5 million. They are now asking for an additional $2 million. And Mike Noel is saying, we don't want to talk about this in an open meeting, but trust me, the money is well spent. Some Republican members of the legislature are a little uncomfortable with that, but that doesn't mean that this group's not going to get its money like it has in the past.
Again, listeners, you can have your say. Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. $5 million paid out to this group, Paul Raleigh, over the past 5 years or so, an additional $2 million. Now $500,000 for another group coming in, having to do with land management. From the unfettered opinion desk, what do you say about, I guess, kind of dark money, money that we're not getting, not oversight of, because I think the legislature actually does see, some members of the legislature do see how this money is spent, but the public, as far as we know, aren't getting a view of that.
Well, then you have to ask why. Why is, you know, Mike Noel says, you know, trust him. Yeah, he said that before. But here's an interesting connection. I mean, there's a guy named Don Pay who's a real powerful lobbyist. He's got ties to the Trump family. He's taken Trump's sons on hunting trips and that sort of thing. And I don't think he's directly part of Big Game Forever, but you know, he's part of that group. They're associated. He is one of the people pushing hard to get Mike Noel appointed to head the BLM.
Right.
And Noel, of course, has always been one of the, probably the biggest critic of the BLM in the legislature. So it's interesting that at least groups tied to Don Pay, they're getting all this money and then they don't have to you know, tell anybody how it's spent. And then they keep coming back for more, and Mike Noel is their big champion.
The timing here, I'm just thinking again, but going back to the story of outdoor retailers leaving Utah because of the state's actions on public lands, they kind of cited Bears Ears National Monument. They also cited Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and the push by the legislature to shrink the boundaries of that. Does this kind of money play into their own complaints about Utah's about what Utah's doing? I'm curious.
I don't know if they've gotten to that level of detail. They've usually kind of stayed at the high end here. But we are clearly in a more contentious environmental fight politically. You know, these battles have lasted generations. And they rise and fall, you know, on the level of intensity. We are clearly at a peak. And this has been building for a while. I think you have some outdoor retailers and some of these environmental groups that are more alarmed because the Republican Party now controls the White House and Congress and many state legislatures. So the way to fight is by political action, like, you know, outdoor retailers leaving the state, or by lawsuit. And so it doesn't surprise me that you would see Republicans then try to bolster the support of groups that might be able to fight those lawsuits.
Okay. And groups that have, as you said, maybe been disenfranchised by politics, by elections.
Right.
You know, we're talking about big asks for money at the legislature. Let's maybe turn now to a couple of additional things that happened this week at the meeting of Utah lawmakers that is currently underway. One of them, a bill we've seen before, constitutional carry, but this year kind of with a twist. Matt Canham, tell us about this.
Yes. Yeah, so the legislature has tried a few times to get a bill passed and into law that would allow anyone to carry a concealed weapon without getting a permit. And the reason we have permits is that some people under law shouldn't be allowed to carry a gun. These are people like felons or there's other restrictions, but they're very few. And so this kind of screens them out. But there's a group that says, look, anyone should be able to get hold a gun, you know, conceal it if they want. One argument was, let's say you're the victim of domestic violence and you don't want to go sit through a class and get a background check and do all this stuff because the person who is assaulting you or has assaulted you can come back at any moment. Why can't I conceal a weapon? So there is some interesting dynamics here. But when it came down to it, the governor has always vetoed this bill and
right.
has threatened to veto it this year as well. Well, that's where they brought in this domestic violence
aspect of
it. If you were if you were, I'm going to screw this up, I think. If you're charged with domestic violence, I'm going to try to make sure I get this right. You have to hand over your gun within, I think it was 24 hours or 48 hours. It was a small window of time where you would have to hand your gun over. Now, this is something that's – there's a separate bill that's just doing that.
Right.
But Lee Perry, who is a representative as well as a lieutenant in the Highway Patrol, is trying to tried to marry these two ideas to make it more palatable for the governor to sign this legislation.
A sort of two-prong approach and loosening some restrictions on firearms while at the same time tightening others. Paul Raleigh, you actually wrote about this from another angle in a column. You described how the second part, that part tied to domestic violence, is not something that the National Rifle Association, the NRA, or lobbyists of theirs at the legislature were able to stomach.
Right. And, when I wrote that column, I talked to a few legislators who are actually you've always been pro-NRA people, members of the NRA. And I mean, our legislature is about as pro NRA and gun rights as any legislature in the country, but to get this permitless carry bill through, they agree that they could marry it to this domestic violence issue and make it more difficult for people who have been charged with domestic violence. Another part of that bill is if someone who has been denied a gun, if they try and buy a gun, the gun dealer is supposed to notify the state authorities immediately and stop them from buying the gun. But the NRA has has offended some of these legislators. There's been some threats made, I'm told, politically. The NRA because they want to separate. They want a permitless bill without being tied to anything.
100% by itself.
Right. Yeah. I wrote that there was a state senator who has always been pro NRA, who threw the NRA lobbyist out of his office last week when he was in there threatening to get him defeated next time if he didn't play ball.
Well, the governor's threatened veto is still looming over there. Matt Cannon, maybe we can just turn back to what happened with this measure.
First off, I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
I found the actual language here. It's if you were convicted of domestic violence, you can't buy, own, or carry a gun.
Okay.
If you have a protective order against you, during the time the protective order is active, you couldn't buy, own, or carry a gun.
Okay.
So that's the idea that was tied in here. What happened? They got deadlocked. In committee, the vote was 5-5, and in our legislative process, a tie means you're dead. The bill now has to either be reworked, or there has to be another vote, or this might just, go on the trash heap for this legislative session, and I would guarantee we'll come back again.
Well, we've got, about 20 days left in the session, so we'll see whether or not it makes its way back. We are out of time, guys, and so we're going to have to turn now to our final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And Matt Canham, are you ready with an underplayed story?
I'm going
to
go back to Jason Chaffetz here. Yesterday, James Evans, the chairman of the Utah Republican Party, held a press conference to tell members of our Utah delegation to no longer hold town hall meetings for the time being, because he was worried about intimidation and violence. If you watched the live stream of this town hall at sltrib.com, it might have been a little intimidating, but violence? There was no violence. One person got ticketed. There was no violence. Even Jason Chaffetz says it was not violent.
Right.
And he also disagrees with the chairman of the Republican Party, saying that he wants to hear from his constituents. It's his job to hear from his constituents. But this debate over how Republicans are going to hold town hall meetings in this country is raging, and this one's an interesting one.
Okay, and I guess, is he advising his fellow Republicans to hold town hall meetings?
He's not talking for the rest of the delegation, but Chaffetz is saying that he will.
Okay. Paul Raleigh, underplayed story of the week for your part?
You know, Senator Mike Lee, when he first got into the Senate, became controversial very quickly by being part of that movement to eventually shut the government down because they wanted to repeal Obamacare and everything else. And he was criticized quite heavily. In fact, there were people looking for Republicans to run against him. Since he's won re-election, he's taken a more low profile. And now he's being taken, he's starting to be one of the voices in the Senate, I think, that people are taking seriously. George Will had a column today, I believe, talking about Lee and his efforts to have Congress get more say in, like, trade wars, trade deals, and things like that.
So Mike Lee is a kind of voice of reason, is your underplayed story of the week there. Paul Raleigh from the Salt Lake Tribune columnist. I'm going to go for my own part with the Tribune reported on this, the archive of Salt Lake Tribune photos that now has a digital home at the Utah Division of State History, 171,000 photographs from the Salt Lake Tribune archives from the 1930s to the 1960s. Check it out. It's really a remarkable archive of photos. Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh, thanks very much for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks as well to Jennifer Dobner and Thomas Burr for joining us earlier. Also to the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means and Tom Williams, Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great holiday weekend.